Lecture 62, May 28, 1964, The Hydrogen Atom and the Periodic Table. Lecture 62, May 28, 1964, The Hydrogen Atom and the Periodic Table. Lecture 62, May 28, 1964, The Hydrogen Atom and the Periodic Table.
For its time. Is it time? Was that clock right? Or are there more guys coming in? Is the clock right?
I think it's right, but I don't understand the bell.
Did you hear the bell?
Oh, you have must bell.
Oh, I have must bell.
I gotta look down the stairwell.
Well, let's go. Historically, the most dramatic success of the quantum mechanics was in understanding the details of the spectra of some simple atoms and also to have an understanding of the mysteries of the periodic table, which the chemists had discovered. So today, I would like to at last bring our quantum mechanics to a point that's closer to the historically important moment, that is the discovery of an understanding of the spectrum of the hydrogen atom, and also to explain to you how, qualitatively, the mysterious properties of the chemicals, elements, can be roughly understood from a little knowledge of quantum mechanics. So today we're going to deal with a distribution of amplitudes in space, and we're actually going to solve a problem in that thing. Some time ago we discussed the forms of the equations, but we didn't solve anything directly. And today we're going to solve the motion of the hydrogen atom. Actually, an electron is a hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron. And I make a number of approximations right away. First, it is possible to deal with both the motion of the electron and the proton, and there is an analog of reducing things to the center of gravity, as there is in quantum mechanics, as there is in classical mechanics. But I won't enter into that. We'll just discuss the case in which we can consider the proton being very heavy and fixed at the center. So we have only the motion of the electron. Next, the electron has a spin, and it obeys the relativistic laws. For both reasons, there are some corrections to what I'm going to do, which is non-relativistic and disregarding small magnetic effects. The small magnetic effects occur because, from the point of view of the electron, which is sort of going around the proton in the old-fashioned way of looking at it, the proton's going around the electron, and there will be a certain magnetic current, magnetic field produced, which the electron will have a different energy with its spin up and down. This is called, this small differences in energy will represent errors in our analysis, but we'll disregard that and we'll suppose that the spinning electron never knows how it's moving in there. It's just like a gyroscope that's moving around in space. It always keeps the same direction. So the conservation of angular momentum is reduced to a conservation of a piece of the angular momentum because the spin part of the angular momentum is constant. So the laws of conservation of angular momentum now refer, in the approximation that we're making, to just the orbital motion, so-called, or the analog in classical physics of the orbital motion. So I'm going to use all our laws about the conservation of angular momentum in a slightly approximate situation in which I completely disregard the fact that the electron has any spin at all, because that's just a constant thing as it goes around. Under these approximations, then, the amplitude to find the electron at different places in space can be represented by a function psi, position of space and time. This is the amplitude to find the electron somewhere at the time t. It should, of course, involve also the amplitude to be found spin up and spin down, but as I say, we forget that. We say it's always up. Then, according to the quantum mechanics, the rate of change of this amplitude with time is given by an operator, the Hamiltonian on the wave function psi. And we've already discussed this. The general form is, for a particle of mass m, minus h squared over 2m times the Laplacian, plus the potential energy. In the hydrogen atom, there's a attraction between the electron and the proton, and so the potential energy is negative the charge squared of an electron divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, which we write as E squared over R. And now what I'm going to worry about are the energy levels. So I'm going to suppose immediately that this psi has a mathematical form of E to the minus I ET over H times some function which I've negligently called by the same letter, some function of R only. And of course, you're familiar with the fact that that means that we need that H psi equal a number times psi. So this is the differential equation to be solved. And this radius is the only way that potential energy depends on anything is via the radius. And so it's much more convenient to solve this equation in polar coordinates than it is in rectangular coordinates. In rectangular coordinates, the Laplacian is the second derivative with respect to x plus the second derivative with respect to y plus the second derivative with respect to z of psi. And I want to transform that horror, or that simplicity rather, to polar coordinates in which the distances r, theta, and phi describe the point. And then I can do this if I think I learned enough out of the math department. But I look through your math textbook, and every time that it comes right down to having anything useful come out of the thing, they just stop. And any so I say hence, but with an exclamation point. It's a rather tedious mess to make the transformation, but suppose that you believe me that this is what happens when you make the transformation, that in terms of the variables r, theta, and phi, this is what happens. If you want to, you probably can make that transformation. All textbooks say give it as a problem, so I give it as a problem too, but it's not very easy. It's a mess, but this is what comes out. You're going to understand what I'm doing anyway. So in terms of r, theta, and phi, the differential equation is minus h squared over 2m times this dribble minus e squared over r times psi equal e psi. Now I'm going to do a simple case first. The wave function psi can, of course, depend on the radius and on the angles and position, but I'm going to consider a special situation in which I look for a solution which does not depend on the angles. Later, we'll find that, since things do not depend on the angles, if you rotate the coordinate system, it doesn't change the amplitude in any way. Therefore, all components of the angular momentum are zero. So this means that the angular momentum is zero. Actually, it's only what we call the orbital angular momentum, which is zero because we still have the spin 1/2. But I forget that for a minute. So orbital angular momentum zero. And incidentally, there's a dictionary which we're going to have to learn because there are names for these things. When you say orbital angular momentum zero, it's equivalent to saying it's called an S state. S for spherically symmetrical. Actually not. The original names of these things were something else, but they don't mean anything today. So it's nicer to remember as spherically symmetrical rather than sharp lines in the spectrum. They're not particularly sharper than the other lines anyway. Now, if the psi does not depend upon theta and phi, then this whole Laplacian thing is just this. This, in fact, we have seen before when we were doing electricity, that the Laplacian radial, when a thing depends only on the radius, is a second derivative of r psi divided by r. And so I get this differential equation. Now, when you have a thing like this to work with, it's a good idea to get rid of all the funny letters in it. That is the constants, e squared, m, h. So clean the thing up a little bit while you do your algebra. And after some thought about that, you can do some things. First, of course, r psi. If you multiply this up by r, you see that r psi is a much more convenient variable than psi, so we call f r psi. Then it will read second derivative of f is e plus something over r times psi. And all these constants can be gotten rid of this way. You see, if you think of changing the scale of r, there are two changes in scale here and one here. So you can get rid of this relative factor by changing the scale of r by a thing which involves h squared over m e squared. In fact, playing around or putting a constant in simplify, you can find that if you write r equal h squared over m e squared times rho, and if you suitably change the scale of e now to get rid of all its constants, And that means, if you follow it out, that you change E by writing it ME fourth over 2H squared times epsilon. In terms of the variables rho and epsilon, the equation is cleaner. All the constants go away. The E, however, I've taken to be negative. I must make a remark about this. This thing will turn out to have solutions for positive energy, for all possibilities of positive energy. That corresponds to an electron coming from the outside that's got enough energy to leave again. It's like the hyperbolic orbits in gravitation. What we want are the things that correspond to the bound states, not ionized. And so we have energy negative. Zero represents the energy at infinity because of the definition of the potential energy here. That's zero energy at infinity. So negative energy means it's a bound object, so that's why I've written it minus epsilon. And if I change the sign of both sides and clean everything up, that's the differential equation. These rho and F and all that, well, now these quantities that appear here are nice units of length and energy, which are important in atomic physics and in the hydrogen atom. And they have been given names by people. H squared over ME squared has been called the Bohr radius. I've named these things so that you learn the words. When you read about them, you know what they are, and it amounts to about 0.528 angstroms, if you put the numbers in. The combination ME fourth over 2H squared is an energy. It's 13.6 electron volts, and it has been given the name 1 Rydberg. But that's just unfortunate that we have so many words to learn. Now we have to solve this differential equation. Well, there's nothing to it. It's just mathematics to solve a differential equation. Yeah, but it's kind of hard mathematics. So I'm going to solve it. Yeah, we're actually going to solve it. We have the second derivative of F with respect to rho is equal to epsilon minus 2 over rho F. It's not easy to solve. And people have discovered the following way of solving it. There is no, it's when you have a general differential equation, there's no unique way to fiddle around it. There's no way to do it. So I only tell you how people have found out. I call epsilon alpha squared for a moment to make it a little easier, so I don't have to write so many square roots. And I make the following substitution. Let f of rho be written as e to the minus alpha rho times another function, g. Why do I make that substitution? You'll find explanations of why in various books, but they're not real. It's only a certain kind of equation for this kind of a substitution works, and there's no generality involved. The derivative with respect to rho of the exponential is minus alpha. And of the not part of the exponential will be g prime. And the second derivative, then, will be obtained by differentiating this again, which produces, I'm sorry, I forgot the g here, which produces alpha squared e to the minus alpha rho g minus alpha e to the minus alpha rho g prime, which occurs from differentiating this one with respect to rho. It also occurs from differentiating that one, hence the two. And finally, this. Second derivative. Now, the point of the thing is that this combination is alpha squared f, and we got the same kind of an alpha squared f on the other side. So when I substitute this in and multiply by e to the alpha rho, I'm going to get this equation. The second derivative of g minus 2 alpha times the first derivative of g. I'm going to put the other thing on the other side. Plus 2 over rho times g is equal to 0. It's a new equation. The happy thing about this equation is that the method of solving it in power series is very effective. Whereas if you try power series in the original equation, it turns out it's possible, but it's much harder to fiddle or find the coefficients. So I now try the substitution g is equal to a power series, which I write as a sum over all values of k of a to the k rho to the k, and try it in here. You don't fool me. I have looked in the math book and found that you have supposedly studied substituting power series in differential equations. If I differentiate twice this thing, I get k times k minus 1 times rho to the k minus 2 times a k from the second derivative. And now if I ought to write three sums, but I'm too late. If I write the next one, that's the first derivative. And then I take the 2 over rho term. I just get this rho to the k minus 1, you see. That must be 0. And now I'm going to rewrite the first term by changing the name of the index from k to k plus 1, because since I sum over all k, that doesn't make any difference. And now I have a power series in which it's true it's a coefficient of rho to the k minus 1 in every term, but if it's going to be 0, the coefficient of the rho to the k minus 1 has to equal 0. In other words, k times k plus 1 times ak plus 1 minus 2 alpha k plus 2 times ak must be 0. In English, that means that ak plus 1 is equal to 2 alpha k. Something's the matter with the sign. Yes, sir, 2 minus 2 alpha k minus 2 over k times k plus 1 ak. That's an order. And so we have essentially that we have the solution. If we start, say, with a certain a, we have to start with k at least 1 because you get into trouble. Otherwise, you can see why if you'll write the power series out. So k begins, k starts at 1. That is, a0 is nothing. K is equal, starts at 1. So you can put A1 in here, and let's get A2, and from A2 get A3, and so you got the whole series. It's interesting to see what the series looks like for the larger terms, what the proximate expansion is. For very large K, this thing behaves like it says that the next term in the series is approximately equal to 2 alpha over K times the last term, roughly. And that means that for large values of K, the series is like 2 alpha to the k over k factorial, because this thing has that property. That is, for very large values of k, the a looks like this. These are the coefficients for the power series 2 alpha to the k rho to the k over k factorial. That series is e to the plus 2 alpha rho. Now, e to the plus 2 alpha rho would be a rough approximation to the solution, and large rho for large rho, which means the higher terms in the series. We have originally our f is e to the minus alpha rho times g, so this solution would have the property that for large rho, the f would behave as e to the alpha rho, which rises as you go further out. It's more and more likely to be further and further away. This is not a legitimate solution. This is an exploding exponential. We have to have a solution which is finite as we go to infinity. So it's nothing the matter. It's not the matter. It is this is a solution of the differential equation, but not of the physical requirements. Physical requirements that the function remain finite at infinity. And so we have to think if there's some other way to beat the game. And there is. Observe that if alpha happened to be, just by luck, 1 over an integer n, then as we started out with a1, you get the next one and so on, the moment that we had an and went to get an plus 1, we would find here 2 alpha n minus 2. See, if we have up in the numerator for the n plus 1 term, 2 alpha n minus 2. But if alpha is 1 over n, this is 0. And therefore, the series stops. It's only a polynomial. It's not an infinite series, and a polynomial times e to the minus alpha rho will remain ultimately finite because the e to the minus alpha rho beats it down. And therefore, the only bound solutions to the Schrödinger equation are those for which alpha is 1 over n, where n is equal to 1, 2, 3, and so on, because you remember k must be at least 1, and the 0 case doesn't come. And therefore, the energy, which you may not remember anymore, is this unit times epsilon, and epsilon was alpha square. So the numerical values of the bound states of hydrogen must be 2m, me fourth over 2h square, times 1 over the square of an integer. And that was already known from the observations of spectra of hydrogen. It was known that the energy levels to an excellent approximation were approaching a limit up here, which was 0, and then there's any number of a whole continuum, positive energies. We call this energy 0. Then if this energy were called minus 1, then this is minus a quarter, minus a ninth, minus a 16th, and so on. And the 1 is 13.6 electron volts and measured. As a matter of fact, spectroscopically, it can be measured to 7 decimal places or 8 decimal places or something like that. So that, as a matter of fact, our best knowledge of the M, E, and H comes from using this formula in reverse, measuring the spectrally how much energy it takes to ionize the hydrogen to there, or to excite to here and multiply by 4/3. And thus determines one of the combinations of the constants. At any rate, this is a grand success of the quantum mechanics because it agrees with the experiment, and this is our first real atom. I would like just to finish this by talking a little bit about what the functions look like. If we take the case n equal 1, then only A1 exists, and A2 is already 0. Taking A1, say, to be 1, we find then that the F for n equals 1, don't worry about all this goop up here. I shouldn't have shown you that board. I think I got nothing on this one. Yes, for n equals 1, it starts, the power series starts rho and has no more terms. So this is, in fact, F. F. But remember that the psi is not F. The psi was R times psi is F. So we have to divide by one more rho to get the behavior of psi. Psi goes as e to the minus alpha. Oh, alpha is 1. E to the minus rho. And therefore, the amplitude to be found at different radial distances, let's say in the scale of the Bohr radius, is an exponential. More likely to be found at the origin and less likely to be found further out. Just an exponential. That's all there is to this whole business. The amplitude to find the electron at different distances from the center is an exponential for n equal 1. Now, for n equal 2, we have two terms in the series, and you can get A2 in terms of A1 from the series. And to make a shortcut, I'll just write down what comes out. For psi, I have divided again by the rho. And I get 1 minus rho over 2 times e to the minus rho over 2. You see, the alpha is 1/2. That's why it's e to the minus alpha rho becomes this. And that solution looks like this. It comes down like so and then comes down here. It has a node, 1, 0. It's just like waves in a box with a sequence of nodes. Any confined wave has a whole lot of modes with no nodes, one node, and the next one comes out this, and you can have fun seeing if you can get the same answer. If you can't, I've made a mistake. Times e to the minus rho over 3. And this thing looks like this and has two nodes. And like any other confined wave, we have a whole sequence of modes, and each mode corresponds, in the case of oscillators, oscillating systems to a definite frequency, but a frequency in the quantum mechanics is energy, and those are the different energies. The only thing now that we have to discuss is a more general situation, case 2, so to speak, in which the psi depends on angles. We assumed in the beginning here that the psi didn't depend on angles. That made it look easy. Look how what a mess we got over there. Well, it's possible to solve the differential equation with the angles in. And, there we are. It's possible to solve the differential equation with the angles in and obtain how it must depend upon angle. However, we can, with our knowledge of quantum mechanics, determine how the amplitude must depend upon angle in the following way. Please forget about the spin and think of the orbital angular momentum as being a conserved quantity. Now, here is a hydrogen atom, and we ask for the amplitude to find an electron here. If the angular momentum, which I call L instead of J because it's orbital, that's all, it's just L, is L. Now, there are very many possible states. There's an M value. We know that this, remark. Obviously, the system doesn't make any difference how you rotate the coordinate system since the potential only depends upon R. And in fact, what I have to say now is true no matter what the function of R was that the potential is. It is 1 over R is not essential. It could be any function of R for the following discussion to be true. The system is independent of rotation, so there's some angular momentum, and they can have M values which run from minus L to plus L. And now suppose it's in one of those, let's say L with M value equal plus 1 or something. With what amplitude will it be found along the z-axis at a distance r? Zero. Because if you found the electron here, what is the angular momentum about the z-axis?
1/2.
Forget about the electron spin. The electron considered without a spin would have zero angular momentum, has zero orbital angular momentum around the z-axis if it's right on the z-axis. So the only way that we can find it up here at this point is that it's in the state L, zero. Zero component of angular momentum along the z-direction. Next problem. Suppose we ask for the amplitude that it's over here at an angle theta phi, I won't draw the phi, at a distance r away. Let's suppose that in this case here, the amplitude to find at a distance r away is called f of r. It depends on r, of course, but it can only come from this state. Now we ask for the amplitude that it's at a distance r away in the state Lm. How can it be? This Lm refers to z. The only way it can be is this, that if you refer the Lm back to z prime and ask for the amplitude that it's in O, L-O, that's the only way it can be found out there. So if we rotate this thing one way or the other, I get my signs mixed up as usual. I should rotate it the other way, but rotate around the z-axis by phi and the y-axis by theta, and ask for the amplitude that we're in L-O. That's the only way it can be found here, if it's in this state already. And then if it is the amplitude that it's found at radius r is f of r. In other words, the amplitude to be found in the state Lm at the position r vectorial depends on angles by this factor and depends on radius in an unknown manner. However, the angular factor is completely determined by our analyses of angular momentum. And so we have this messy thing, which we worked out last time in a couple of cases. This is sometimes called YLM of theta and phi. It's just a function of theta and phi. It has different names. That means, some people would like to write it that way, that the wave function must be f of r, a function of radius, times this particular function of angles. Actually, there's a difference as a factor in here. It doesn't make any difference in it. No, if we were to substitute this function into the Schrödinger equation, it must be a solution. Now, how can it be? If we look at this Schrödinger equation here, with this horror substituted for the Laplacian, and with this monster put in for psi, then we notice here that this term doesn't do anything to the y factor, because it depends only on angles. It comes out as a factor. So in the Laplacian, imagine a Laplacian written in here. So I got all this stuff plus this plus this. This does nothing to the y, and this does nothing to the y. In other words, all the terms are proportional to y except this. But it must be a differential equation, this must be a solution. Therefore, this itself must be proportional to y. That is to say, y must have the property that if you put all that goop about the angles from the angular variation of the Laplacian, operating on y must be a multiple of y, or else it wouldn't be a solution, and we know it's got to be right, so this ought to be true. And the coefficient, the constant, incidentally, can't depend upon m. It can't depend upon m because the energy of the system can't depend upon m, and after we've eliminated all the angles, the equation that we get that remains must not have any m dependence, or else the energy would depend on m. But we know physically that the energy can't depend on m. So this is independent of m. That permits us to determine it fairly easily because we know at least one of these y's in the general case. That y is that it goes sine theta to the l theta to the il phi is the case when m is equal to l. Well, if you'll just substitute that in here, and it's not worth your time to look into details, but believe me, I did it right. The net result is, if you differentiate this thing and substitute it in this side, sure enough, you get L times L plus 1 times the same thing. And therefore, CL is minus L times L plus 1 for every M. Okay, that's nice. And then, when we substitute this solution in there, All this terror of mass over here just becomes minus L times L plus 1 over R squared. Therefore, when we come down to the next line down here, when we write this down, we have the old piece of the Laplacian, which we had before. We have the potential that we had before, which I've written now as V of R, but in the hydrogen atom is minus E squared over R. We have the energy term, and I have written another term, which comes from saying that this piece of the Laplacian is minus L times L plus 1. I multiplied by the H squared over 2m to write this. So the radial motion equation now is different only in that to the potential energy that was there before is a new mysterious term is added. The new mysterious term, however, is easy to understand physically, and therefore, although I obtained it through all this mathematical shenanigans, I would like to explain that such a thing is sort of expected, roughly speaking, by classical mechanics. It's sometimes worthwhile to have some feeling that things aren't terribly mysterious. Anyway, what was this do? What says that if this says that there's an equation for radial motion for a cis object which has angular momentum HL, that the radial motion is the same as it would have been if it didn't have any angular momentum, except that the potential energy has an extra term. Why? If you were to analyze the motion of a particle going around another, a center, then the kinetic energy has a radial part, that is R dot squared times M over 2 would be the radial part of the kinetic energy. But if it's got a sideways motion too, the kinetic energy altogether is M times the R theta dot, that's the horizontal component of velocity squared, that's the kinetic energy. And then the potential energy would be some function of R, and this would be the total energy. Now, if you know that the angular momentum is, say, capital L, say, okay? So if the angular momentum is capital L, that's the mass times the radial velocity, I mean the tangential velocity times the radius. It's mv tangential r, which is so that mr theta dot, well, so that r theta dot is L over mr. So if the angular momentum is known and is in fact a constant of the motion, as you know, I can replace the kinetic energy. I always know what the, if I know how far away it is, I always know what the tangential velocity must be. And so I can replace this term by its equal. By using for R theta L over MR in here, I obtain 1 over 2m times L square over R square. And you see that the quantum mechanics replaces this L square by H times L plus 1. I think you remember in a few cases we pointed out that in classical mechanics, the square of the angular momentum, which appears, is often replaced not by HL squared, but by H times L plus 1. And this is another example of the same thing. So you can understand this as a centrifugal, the potential that corresponds to centrifugal force. Next, now, we have to solve this differential equation for instead of the other one. And it turns out that I will make the changes, indicate what happens, or you should try it yourself to find, make sure that what happens in these equations is as following. I can't find it. Something like this, plus or minus, in here, L times L plus 1 over R, rho square enters in here from this term, plus or minus. Then when you make the same substitution, it'll work just as well, but there's an additional term, minus 1 L times L plus 1 over rho squared G. And when you get all the way down to here, when you follow this all the way out, you'll find that the net result is, I mean, I just tell you this, you can work it out yourself, I hope, that this has just minus L times L plus 1 in it. That's all that's changed. And the net result has two changes. First, that the K must start from L plus 1. Otherwise, this will be 0, and it gets into trouble. So the first value of K in the series is L plus 1 rather than 1. Next, the energies are exactly the same. because the numerator has to be zero for the same reason, and the formula for the energy is the same. So we have the following thing, that for L equals zero, N equals 1, 2, 3, and so on. However, for L equal 1, we have to start, we don't have any terms less than 2. So it starts with N equal 2, 3, 4, and so on. For L equal 2, the only possibilities are N equal 3, 4, 5, and so on. That was done very briefly and very quickly. It appears in many quantum mechanics books, and if you're interested in further details, I advise you to read them. I think only that we should understand what, that it's possible that something like this happens anyway. I would like now to describe the behavior of these functions because they're very interesting and important in the applications of quantum mechanics much more generally. The reason is that these shapes, these functional shapes, appear for any radial, for any potential function of the radius. And it's not just for hydrogen atom alone. So let me describe these states. I have here a dictionary of states. It turns out that for historical reasons, it was discovered that there were different kinds of levels and so forth, and they were given names originally, letters, because it wasn't known what it was. And we still use those letters to describe the states, even though we understand the inner workings. So it's necessary to do physics to memorize some words, some letters to represent some numbers. Just like it is to have to remember, instead of saying 1, 2, 3, 4, to say hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium. That's just another way of saying numbers. Element 27 is, what is it, copper? I don't know. Cobalt. All right. In the same way, we have a set of letters, S, P, D, F. After that, it's easy. F, G, H, I, J, K. Which represent the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as far as L is concerned. A state with L equals 0, has only one possible value of M, 0, is called an S state. There's only one such state. The angular distribution is spherically symmetrical. That's how I remember S is spherical. But incidentally, the wave function approaches a constant for small r. If you look at the thing in space, I've only drawn two of the three dimensions, the simplest solution is positive everywhere. However, there may be radial nodes where it's positive and then negative, or positive, negative, positive, as the amplitude can vary that way, but it doesn't depend on angle. Next, the L equals 1 states are called P states. I can't think of a good way to remember that. It has three possible states with M equal plus 1, 0, and minus 1. The angular dependence of those states are given by these, you know, those transformation things, which we have found out for spin 1 long ago. In the look at the central diagonal of the table for 3x3, you'll find these three functions. So the angular dependence looks like this one, or this one, or this one. Let's take this one. It means that the wave function will be, say, positive for positive angles and negative for negative angles. For theta equals 90 degrees is 0. That means that the nodes now are planes rather than radiated. They're planes. It's a thing which has a nodal plane along the XY plane. It can also have radial nodes. That corresponds to higher values of M. But I won't worry about that now. We're worrying about the angular variation. It's positive on one side, negative on the other, has a nodal plane. So you think, oh, I know what the other two solutions are, nodal plane along X, Y, Z, and nodal plane. Yeah, that's right. But those don't happen to be these two, but rather linear combinations of these two. The sum of these two divided by the square root of 2, which is also, of course, a possible solution, is one with an X type instead of Z, with a nodal plane and a YZ plane. And the difference of these two divided by a root of 2 times I is the Y type. So there are really three functions. You can put it this way if you want, or the other way, nodal plane, XY nodal plane, and a ZY plane, and nodal plane on the XZ plane. Now you can have more nodal planes or nodal surfaces in angle, and the next level is L equal 2, which are called D states, and they have five possible values of M, and their angular dependence was worked out last time amid much consternation. We worked out the LM, L0, for the case L equals 2, and got this horrible list of things. And I don't think you need to memorize all of them. Perhaps it's just worthwhile to memorize the central one as the most important one. At any rate, it's a complicated angular distribution and has two nodes as your variant angle. I forgot to mention here that the wave function goes as r for small r. That's this fact here. And that has a significance, that the probability to be found at the origin is zero. Because yeah, if the thing has angular momentum, it isn't going to be found at the origin. Sit there and have angular momentum? No. So that amplitude to be found at the origin is zero as long as it has any angular momentum. And the more angular momentum it has, the harder it is to get it near the origin, as you can appreciate. If a thing has a lot of angular momentum and you try to pull in and go get a lot of energy, and it's very hard to get into that region of high energy. This is the quantum analog of the skater business. As you pull in the arm, it goes faster and there's a lot more energy in it. So with the one unit, psi goes as r. But with two units of angular momentum, psi goes as r squared near the origin, which means it's still less likely to be found near the origin for angular momentum 2 than for angular momentum 1. And so on, it gets less and less likely to be found at the origin, and that's reflected in this. That if we go on with this game, taking L equal 3, that's called an F state. L equal 4 is called a G state. L equal 5 is called an H state, etc. There are two L plus 1 states of each kind and so on, and the angular variations are given by this transformation thing. But the thing that's interesting is that psi varies as the Lth power of r for small r. I would better point out that although I worked that out for hydrogen, it's true in any general potential that's anywhere near reasonable. Because as r gets small, this goes inversely as the square of the distance, and any ordinary potential doesn't vary that fast. So for very tiny r, the whole equation is dominated by this. And therefore, the behavior at small r for the hydrogen atom and for any other system is the same. And now I would like to make application of this hydrogen spectrum theory in a very sloppy way, I mean as approximate way, to a discussion of the structure of the periodic table. In the periodic table, we have elements which have many more electrons than one. And in order to find the answer, we will have to solve equations with many more variables. If we disregard the spin again and just take the equation with two electrons, I've happened to have written it here just to show you a complicated looking thing. For the helium atom, the wave function is the amplitude to be found. That one electron is at x1, y1, z1, and the other is x2, y2, z2. It satisfies an equation, if you want the energy levels, where an operation on psi is a number times psi, where that operation on psi is given this way, which is more complicated. It involves six variables, and no one has solved it analytically. They've solved it by approximate numerical methods, which we won't describe. And that's only two electrons. You get the 3, 4, 5, and so on, it's hopeless to solve it exactly. And therefore, to claim that the quantum mechanics understands the periodic table exactly is going too far. So if you permit me a very sloppy approximation, I'll be able to describe qualitatively some of the aspects of the periodic table, or the properties of the various elements. The approximation I'm going to make is a reasonable, not very bad, actually. It's sort of poor, but not very bad. And that is that the various electrons, on the average, we can disregard the details of the interaction between the various electrons on the average, that if we take an atom like neon with 10 electrons, we can say that, so to speak, one of the electrons sees some kind of an average potential, which is a net result of the nucleus and the other 9 electrons, and that this average potential is more or less the same for each electron. In other words, we disregard or we simplify the interaction between the electrons by simply replacing it by changing the effective, by making them each electron moves in a central potential, V of r instead of this, which V of r is supposed to roughly represent the average charge density from all the other electrons. And then each electron is sort of is independent of the others. And each electron then can take up a set of states. It can fill up. It can go. It has many different states it can be in. However, You cannot put more than one electron in the same state on account of the fact that the particles are Fermi particles. But one remark, the states that we've been talking about so far, we didn't consider the spin. Each state is therefore really double. It could have spin up, and then it could have spin down. And then the next state, then you have to go to another level, another kind of wave function, if you have a third particle. So with that understanding, I start to describe what happens, roughly speaking. We have an hydrogen, only a 1s, and in the chemistry, we always deal with the atom in the lowest energy state that it can get into. And this symbol 1s means that n equals 1 and that it's an s state, and that's the lowest state of hydrogen down here. And the spin is either way, it's one way or the other. And that's hydrogen, that's easy enough. Now helium, one of the electrons can be in a 1s state, and the other electron also in the 1s state, although one has a spin up and the other has a spin down. So you have two electrons in the 1s state, and that's a helium, right? Next, we take lithium, that has three. Now, if you put one in the 1s state and the other in a 1s state, then the third electron can't get into the lowest possible state of the system because both of them are occupied, and we have to go into the next higher state. In the case of hydrogen, although I've written only these are the S states here for L equals 0, the L equal 1 states, or P states, we found have the same energy levels, and they're exactly the same, only there's no lowest one. And the D states are the same again, only there's the two bottom ones are missing, so that the levels look like this. This is called a 2p state, and it's called a 3p, and so on, the first number representing the value of n. So this would represent a 3d state, and so on. However, the energy of this and this are equal, and the energy of these three are exactly equal, as the energy only depends upon n. On the other hand, in an atom, when we put the lithium, when we put the third electron in the lithium, then a question comes. Is it going to be a 2s electron, or is it going to be a 2p electron? Which is lower? Well, the hydrogen and the lithium aren't exactly the same. The lithium is the actual potential isn't just a single charge, but is partially shielded. The potential energy when it's close in is 3 units because of the nuclear charge. But when it's further out, it's weaker. When it gets very far out, it's only 1 unit. It's stronger near the center than the regular 1 over R curve. And so, therefore, of the two functions, 2s and 2p, the one which has a greater chance to be in the center has a lower energy because it feels the extra attraction of the nucleus more. And as we already studied how these things vary with radial distance, the one with angular momentum stays away from the origin, while the one with zero angular momentum has some chance to be near the center. Therefore, the 2s state is lower, and then lithium is so. It turns out that we can then keep on going with this and that we have a series of rules for filling. The lowest state is 1s, and the next state for when you think of these as being filled up is 2s, as I've just explained. After we fill up the 2s, which will occur at beryllium, then we begin to fill up the 2p's, which are a little bit higher than the 2s's for the reason just explained. In the same way, the next level is 3s, and then comes 3p, and then, surprisingly, the 4s, you're looking for the 3D. But the 3D is so high up that the 4s and 3D are almost exactly the same. And the 4P is up here, and so on. And that's as much as we're going to study today. But let's see what happens. I wrote it right here where I can't have it when I have the slide. But what's going to happen is we're going to fill the first element is hydrogen with one electron here, the next one's helium with two there. Then comes lithium with one here, and then comes beryllium with two here. After that, boron comes and puts one electron in here. There are six possible electrons that can go in here, because there are three possible p states, and each one has two spins. Incidentally, a very interesting question comes which I must say a word about. Suppose that we, in the case of boron, we had one 2p filled up, say with spin up. Now that couldn't be an X or a Y or a Z state. Suppose it's a Z state. Now we put another electron in. Will it be in the same one or a different one or upside down spin or what? In other words, the next electron which occurs in the case of carbon, will that be 2Z down or will it be 2X up or what will it be? And the answer is this. We disregarded the Coulomb repulsion between the electrons or we averaged it out. But by taking functions which are different, there's less overlap. The other things being equal, the repulsion tries to keep the electrons away from each other. And so they it isn't this state, but this one that's occupied. So here we now look at the periodic table on the next slide. I mean, not the periodic table, but a list of the elements and how the things are filled up, just to illustrate a few points, which you probably all know from having studied chemistry, but I tell you about it anyway, just so once for a change, you can hear something you already know. So you fill up the hydrogen and the helium. And I've written here the amount of energy needed to pull an electron away from the atom. It's a very rough way of getting some idea of how reactive the chemical is, but it's not very good because in real life and chemical effects, these things are in the environment of other atoms. And this ionization potential voltage that I've written, these are ionization potentials, represent the energy needed to remove an electron into a vacuum, which is not a good measure, but it's a rough measure of a chemical ability. It's very hard to pull the electron off the helium. It's harder than to pull it off the hydrogen because the helium attracts with 2 units of charge minus some fraction, not a complete one. Sometimes one is inside the other. So it's attracted more than it is in the case of hydrogen, and it's more energy. It's so hard to get the electron off that today, up till now, no other substance will pull the electron off the helium, and there is no chemical reactions with helium. So helium is inert chemically. Next element is lithium, which has to put its electron in the 1s, in the 2s state, and it's very far out and weakly attracted and very easily removed. Now, as we increase the charge, it's harder to remove for the same reason that it's harder to remove from here. The charge being higher attracts the electron more. The third, the boron, has to start filling up the P shell. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the filling up the P shell. You might even notice that the ionization potentials have a rising and then fall a little bit, or at least don't rise as fast for a moment, after the half-filled position. And that's the reason for that is the one that I just explained. The repulsion makes it nice that they be in three opposite, different states. So as you fill them up, there's one this way, then one this way, and then one the other way, and the next one has to be put into a state which overlaps one of them, and so that the energies are just a little bit less good for the next electron as it was in the last. And of course, there's a continuous change going on away here because each atom is different, but this jig in here is due to this tendency for a half-filled shell to be a little bit more stable than a completely filled shell for the reason explained that the moment you go beyond half, you have to make them overlap, and the repulsion does that. So there's a lot of little details that you can understand in this thing, too. After we fill up the 2p, we start to fill up the 3s and the 3p in the same manner as we did before, and much of what we saw before is essentially repeated. Oh, I forgot that. When we fill up the 2p completely, we have a lot of attraction, and the next level is a big jump to 3s. So it's hard again to get a neon to react. In fact, it hasn't been done yet. Next, we do the next column, and it has the same kind of behaviors here, and the chemistry is very similar. Any of you well know the elements have a correspondence like fluorine to chlorine, neon to argon, and so on. When we go to fill up the next level, we fill up the 4s's first, but then the 3d's come because they're a little bit lower. In fact, they're about the same energy as a 4s. And here is, in fact, a very peculiar thing happens. The 4s and 3d are so much the same that the half-filled shell business, in the case, the extra binding of the half-filled shell sucks the electron away from the 4s in order to fill it. It should be 4 and 2, but it would rather be 5 and 1. Right? Then we have, so that's another example of the tendency to make a half-filled shell as especially low energy. Now it goes on like this until we have getting near the filled shell, and the same thing happens with a completely full shell A completely full shell is a nice, stable structure. And so instead of being 9-2, it sucks one away and makes 10-1. It doesn't suck it very hard. It's easy to get it out again. This thing is nearly, it's not much energy away from the 9-2. So the valence of copper is 2. You can either remove this electron relatively easily or remove 2 of them and leave 9 here. The next elements in here come down filling the P-shell after you fill this one. This is not a rare earth element, although you might expect it because you have filled shells. It's very hard to judge ahead of time what's going to be a rare earth, an inert element, a noble gas. It's not possible without quantitative analysis to know how big this number is going to be. How far away is the 4P energy? How complete is the shell? So although most books make it look like it's perfectly obvious where each of the shells is filled, it is far from obvious. There's no evident reason why beryllium isn't a complete shell. It's just that the 2P is so close to the 2S that the extra energy isn't enough to make this too stable. And then the same thing happened here. But it does turn out that by the time you finally fill the 4P, the next energy is far enough away that krypton is again a noble gas. Some of the noble gases, of course, do react. I think krypton, but at least I know xenon, reacts with fluorine, for instance, although it's not with many other substances. This thing is not exactly right. There are some irregularities. For example, in the case of carbon, when carbon is near an environment, this isn't the state. Rather, one of these 2s's goes into 2p to make 3 2p's and 1 1s. And then, due to the tendency to fill the shell, it's not very far away in energy. And in the environment of other atoms, it turns out to be lower. So the valence of carbon is 4 rather than 2, as you'd expect here. I would like to illustrate one more point, if I could have the lights, that we not only understand the valences to some extent, but even qualitatively some of the directional properties of the valences. Look at, if we take a thing like oxygen, which has 6, which if you looked at oxygen, I forget where it is, it has 4 2p electrons. The first 3 fill up all these states, and the next one, say 2z, is a 2pz. Then missing, the empty ones are 2px and 2py, which are functions at right angles to each other, not overlapping. And so when there's an extra electron brought in by bringing in a hydrogen, that extra electron fits better into the 2px orbit if it's over here at this side, while the other hydrogen's at right angles. So the water molecule has the 2 hydrogens at right angles to the oxygen. No. The hydrogens repel each other and so on, and it's not exact, but it's 105 degrees. However, with the larger atom, sulfur, in which the same thing is happening at the 3p level, the angle is 94 or 92, I forget. And if you go to selenium hydride, it's closer to 90 degrees, showing that we are on the right track. One more, the case of nitrogen. Nitrogen has 3 2p electrons filled, and the extra electrons that are brought in by the 3 hydrogens will like to fill the 3 2p things, which are x, a y, and a z. So the 3 hydrogens like to sit at right angles to each other away from the nitrogen. It's not exactly right angles. It's a little opener, more open. But that's the reason that the ammonia molecule is not on a plane, but has 3 hydrogens with the nitrogen above. The case of phosphine, pH3, the angle is again closer to 90 degrees, and for arsenine, is still closer to 90 degrees. So it has been a tremendous triumph of physics to have found the underlying machinery of atomic structure and for chemistry. Thank you very much. Have all this in chemistry, this part.
Krypton does react -43
with fluorine.
Discharged.
I remember that xenon did, but I couldn't remember whether krypton did. Thank you. Yeah, right. But no one's got neon to go yet, have they? Or argon, I mean. No, okay. No. Look out, he's taking a picture. Thank you, though. I forgot which, I wasn't sure.
Even barium xenate has been made.
Huh?
Barium xenate has been made, too.
BA xenon oxide. Is that the idea? Uh-huh. It was really quite a shock that the thing is possible to make. Is it the only compound of krypton is a fluoride? The only compound of krypton so far is a fluoride?
Right.
Are you working on trying to make something else?
We're trying to make the chloride.
The chloride?
No one's been successful.
Not even with xenon.
No.
Well, that may be a numerical question. I mean, the energy of the chlorine may not be enough if chlorine is so reactive.
We've also tried to make a cesium pentachloride.
Cesium what?
Pentachloride.
Oh.
By analogy.
Oh, yeah.
We tried it. We might have gotten it, but it was such a small amount we couldn't do anything.
Jesus, that would be interesting. That would really be interesting. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, I work under Dr. Libby over at UCLA.
Of course, now with cesium, it's harder to pull off the other electrons than with xenon because you've got the extra charge of the nucleus, one more unit than you had before. I mean, you take off the electron, the extra one electron, the extra, and then you have the cesium looks like xenon, but the energy to pull electron off is even higher because, but it's the other way. We're trying to, no. What happens in these compounds? Do we take electrons away from the xenon and give them to the fluorine?
Yeah, the fluorine is looking for an electron.
Right, so you see, to suck it out is hard. Yeah, fluorine is looking, trying to make itself into a neon. Right, so it has to suck an electron, and it may be too hard to get the next electron after it's got one charge in it.
What's amazing is the xenon, the fluorine reactor, just high temperatures, all you have to do is increase the temperature. Just a simple reaction.
Yeah, that's funny. That was peculiar, yeah. Well, thanks for it. Did I say I got something all screwed up?
He does.
Oh, he does.
Well, the question of writing about circular polarized, you don't have to like that, but also about
that. Yeah, everybody gets screwed up. I helped to screw everybody up by using the opposite definition of the standard one.